Hello, Poisonees. This episode is landing during our mini break before starting season 3 of The Poisoner's Cabinet. This is when Nick and Sinead are spending their time planning lots of new content for the new season and also, somewhat unexpectedly, are also recovering from a mild bout of COVID. We're fine, don't worry. As we often do during our seasonal breaks, we're bringing you another one of our exclusive Patreon episodes for free to keep your ears happy and to give you a taste of what we do over on our subscriber channel. The episode you're about to hear was originally recorded in January 2022, when Sinead was suffering through dry January and Nick was full of cider, and it contains a selection of smaller stories which we've called the Compendium of Stupidity for reasons that will soon become clear. For those of you who don't know, Patreon is a subscriber channel where you can support our podcast for $5 a month, and for that you get an extra episode every single week as well as other fun content. On Patreon, we cover stories featuring poison and all manner of mayhem, including modern cases, cults, and some quite gruesome not-safe-for-work stories. This is where you'll find our take on cases including Rasputin, Ed Gein, Jonestown, and the 1904 Olympics, trust me, look it up, as well as extra special episodes with extra special guests. Patreon is a wonderful community with lots of great chat and debates amongst our subscribers about each episode. And best of all, it's completely flexible. If you subscribe, you'll get access to the full back catalogue, so it's always worth going over and having a look, or feel free to ask us questions about it. So we'll be back very soon for season 3 of The Poisoner's Cabinet. In the meantime, make sure you are following us on social media for regular updates of what we're doing next, and enjoy this Patreon taster. Hello, Poison Patreons. Welcome to another episode of Deadly Nightcaps with me, Sinead.
And me, Nick.
Bringing you more tales of poisoning and murder cases, old and new, all washed down with drinks that make your woods haunted. Thanks to all of our lovely, delicious new Patreon subscribers. We hope you're having a lovely week.
Yes, indeed. Hope everyone has having a delightful time out there.
Indeed. Every week with that intro, I look round my room and go, what can I use as a drinks that make your something something? And I just go, your picture's on the wall. What? No.
No, don't do that.
I'm joking. How are you, Nick?
I'm all right.
Yeah,
it's the start of a new week. So many possibilities and excitement to be had.
Yeah, still feeling the joys of January, I see.
Well, we shall see.
Oh, we shall see. Until Blue Monday hits.
So far, so good.
That's nice.
And also, cool. I'm not doing Dry January, so that makes things a million times better.
Okay, you're just going to rub that in every week
really
now,
am.
Aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And not every week, every day, every hour I text you.
Just every so often you come over and twist the knife another quarter inch.
Yep.
Well, speaking of which, what are you drinking, Nick?
I'm having a gin and tonic.
What? Do they mix?
They apparently, I've heard it tell. I'm trying something new. Ooh. I put some tonic in my gin.
Oh, is it delicious? What gin are you having?
This is just a Tanqueray, this one.
Oh, just a Tanqueray. Just a Tanqueray.
I did,
just
I
a wonderful gin.
I perused the selection of gin and I thought, no, I'm going just to keep it classic, keep it simple. Don't want anything too fancy.
Well, I am enjoying a Negroni.
Are you? Now,
I am.
Are you enjoying it?
I actually
you
am.
Have a Negroni.
I have a Negroni. So this is a non-alcoholic cocktail. This is by Seedlip, I think, actually. I think it's really, really small print on the bottle. But it's a tiny bottle, and it's called Negroni. And it gives you all the flavours and the spice and the aromatics, but unfortunately no booze with it.
Yes, no, that's the best. But the best part of Negroni is just how wasted you get.
I'm yes, sorry. And jolly you get
yeah,
with it.
Yeah, I get... No, so if I had a Negroni and I did not have those side effects, I would be bitterly, bitterly disappointed.
As
angry.
Bitter as the Negroni itself.
Yeah, more so. More so, I feel. Because that's what I go to a Negroni for. Jollity and silliness.
You don't go for taste or anything.
No,
absolutely not. Screw it.
No.
I'm surprised you don't just drink White Lightning or something, Nick, with that kind of logic. I just want to not feel feelings.
Harsh.
I don't know, the way you're saying it, it's like, I just want to get wasted, and it's fine.
No, the Negronis in particular have some bizarre effect on me.
They do.
That other alcohol doesn't. Just like a gin and tonic, yeah, very pleasant, but I don't get drunk, but Negronis send me insane.
They do, in a good way. In a good way, not an absence way, but a good way. I will say this Negroni, it sounds so bad to say yeah. It sounds sinful. It's a really nice cocktail if you don't mind, if you actually like your bitter cocktails and you like the taste of Negroni, and it does grow on you. It's very close to a taste of Negroni, so it's quite pleasant. I'm finding it perfectly pleasant.
Well, I'm glad you're enjoying it.
I am. I'm gonna sip it now. Oh, it's not the same. I think it's really nice, actually. Of all of some I've tasted that are just like, what is this? This is just air. That's not a bad one.
Well, I'm glad you found something jolly.
Anything or anyone you would like to poison this week, Nick?
No, I don't think so.
No.
I was just racking my brains. And I thought, no, everything's been quite pleasant so far.
It has, hasn't it? January has proven to be quite pleasant so far for me.
Had a nice weekend of playing some games, which was good fun. Playing some games. So
you did.
That was quite pleasant.
That was nice.
So no one has earned my wrath as of yet. But it is early, so I leave that proviso to change my mind later on in the week.
I know. We're both in very good moods for January. Normally January is a time of misery and sadness.
Oh, well, also, we're normally drunk.
Yeah. I'm now on the dry January, the first week, so I'm riding that wave of, I mean, you know, actually, it's really feeling quite zen and lovely, and I don't think I actually need alcohol anymore. Give it a week. And then the killings will begin. Well, Nick, shall we talk about murder and poison and silly things for a bit?
All the fun stuff in life.
Well, it's my episode this week, and I've got something a bit different for you. It is a compendium episode.
Ooh, now you're stealing the compendium format, are you?
I am going with a duo rather than a trilogy.
Okay.
Or it may turn into a trilogy if I don't have enough time and I need to pad for a bit. No, going with the compendium episode. Also, who made you the mayor of compendium episodes?
Me. I did. I did the first one, therefore they all belong to me.
Well, there's a new sheriff in town, mate, so buckle up. So it's a companion episode, as we've said before. You research little stories and you kind of think, oh, they're really good. Can we make a whole episode out of them? Yeah, yeah. These are both, in the spirit of Dry January, drink-related, in a way.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. One is a story of a murderer who almost escaped justice. But the first one I'm going to tell you, with a few other little stories in there as well, is a tale of how beer can kill you.
Okay.
It can, you know.
I can think of a few ways.
Sneaks into your house at night, strangles you.
That's one way. It wasn't the first one that leapt to mind, I must admit.
No. Okay. Well, the reason that I found the story that I'm about to tell you is that I did go down a Google rabbit hole, as I do when researching, trying to find interesting stories of murder and death and reasons why we're on a watch list. But I ended up looking up weird and stupid stories of death and interesting ways in which a person can die. And I really did find some gems. And you don't have to go that far, and then you suddenly find things and go, why did I never hear about this? These aren't murders, but they are bizarre, and there's a few I could not read out. In my research, I found the story of John Cummings, who, after seeing a circus knife swallower, decided that he would start swallowing knives completely. And he swallowed four knives, three of which he passed and had no ill effects.
Okay, that's impressive. Obviously, he's got a very, very straight intestine.
That's probably it. By the time he was done.
No turns or corners in there. It's just straight in and out.
Yes, he was a long, long man. He went on to swallow 14 knives. And then after some days of abdominal pain, they all came out. They all came out.
Along with most of the rest of his insides as well.
Yes, he was a thin man by the end of it. He finally swallowed 20 knives and a switchblade, I think. But he'd only passed the switchblade after a few days. And 4 years later of pain, he eventually died. And the autopsy found that there were between 30 and 40 fragments of metal, wood and blade and horn in his stomach.
This is a stupid man.
Yes, a stupid man. There is a condition, I think, actually. People, they eat pins and they eat metal.
Yes,
they've got
true.
Compulsion.
This is true. Yes.
So I thought he was quite an idiot.
Yes, actually, I knew someone who ate paperclip.
Actually knew them.
Yes, I actually knew them, yes. This person I went to college with, they had a thing there. Not folded up ones, so they tend to go. They tend to pass through because they were sort of more rounded. But yeah, she used to eat paperclips.
Oh my god! Did she ever explain why?
No, as you say, it was just one of those weird compulsions. That, just had to be done.
Nice.
Very
a couple of other little ones as well, of nice ways to go. Governor Morris, first name Governor Morris, one of the founding fathers of America, he died in 1816 while he was trying to clear his urinary tract from an infection, clearing a blockage using a whalebone.
Ow. 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 Some people like that.
Oh, come on! A whale bone away. Yeah, I just, he thought that that was the way to fix it.
That was the way to clear a blockage out.
Clear the blockage.
If you got, if your pipes are backed up or whatever, you get the rod in there and you give it a good old scrubbing.
Clear the traps.
Exactly. Clear it all out. Poke something down there. Yeah.
There you go.
I understand the terrifying logic.
Exactly. Not to outdo the Americans, British MP Sir William Payne Galway, it might have been pronounced, in 1881. I just love this sentence. He died after sustaining severe injuries when he fell on a turnip while hunting.
Nice. Death by turnip.
He was savaged by a turnip.
Savaged by a turnip.
That's just a very interesting footnote, isn't it?
That's brilliant. So he was impaled upon a turnip.
He fell on a turnip while hunting.
Right.
I need to research his whole story and obviously tell his tale.
He may well have... He's hunting with a gun. He tripped on a turnip and blew his head off or something.
Well, maybe. Maybe that was... No, it was internal injuries. Internal. He just must have landed on turnip in the wrong place.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Accidentally fell on a turnip.
Oh, God!
Yeah, like hell.
He'd learned from Governor Morris.
He was into some kinky shit.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah.
That had not occurred.
I'm sure A&E is full of people who fell on stuff.
Oh, God. He was the first instance of that. And he's an MP as well. He's a British MP.
Well,
of course, that's what happened.
If you're an MP, you've got to be into some weird shit.
He died brutally after accidentally sitting on a turnip whilst hunting. Oh, God. I don't think we're going to top that now. The final one, I didn't know this. So Clement Vallandigham,
good name,
US politician, he died in 1871 after accidentally shooting himself in the stomach with a pistol while demonstrating how a man he was defending in court couldn't have actually shot his victim because his victim shot himself in the stomach.
Nice.
He was representing a defendant named Thomas McGeehan, who was accused of killing a man in a barroom brawl in Ohio. And Clement wanted to demonstrate that the victim had shot himself while trying to retrieve his pistol from his pocket. He was kneeling position. He was coming up and the gun went off and he shot himself. And while demonstrating to the other attorneys, he thought he was using an unloaded pistol. He went, look, and then shot himself in the stomach. The good thing is the defendant got off.
Nice. Okay.
He very much proved his point, and they went, oh, okay. Thomas McKeon got off. He was acquitted, but he was shot to death 4 years later in a saloon.
Nice. Okay.
Yes. So there you go. Yes, it's a crazy, crazy world of crazy deaths. I don't think we'll top Sir William Payne Galway.
No.
Let's research his story more.
He certainly didn't top anything. He was quite the opposite.
That was a good day for him. What vegetables had he started with, and he'd upgraded to turnips? Anyway,
you to a turnip? Just,
I mean, it's an odd.
I mean,
leap.
It's a peculiar shape, isn't it? A turnip.
It is. Maybe that was his
more
thing.
More bulbous than.
This has gone
I'm
to a place.
Shut up now. It's going to get weird if I carry on.
Yeah, and me thinking this episode wouldn't last long enough. Here it is. On to our other story, and it's a serious yet slightly amusing story of bizarre deaths. You all know that I'm off the drink this month, and it's a good thing because sometimes the drink can kill you. And in 1814 in London, it literally did. In 1814, the Mew Brewery was one of the largest in London.
I know this story.
You know this story? It was the largest other than Whitbread, which is still going, operated in the Horseshoe Brewery at the junction of Tottenham Court Road and Oxford Street, which are the two of the most popular streets in London. At the time, they were busy, but it's also, at the time, right in front of St Giles Rookery, which is a perpetually decaying slum.
Jolly.
Seemingly always on the verge of social and economic collapse, it was said, and was the inspiration for Gin Lane by Hogarth.
I mean, it's most of London is like that, to be honest.
Yes, this one was particularly shitty, though. Particularly ginny. Now, the Muir Brewery only brewed porter, which, as we know, is a sort of stout. And they were known, the Muir family of brewers, for their incredibly large brewing vats. The owners and the family had been constructing the biggest vats in the universe for years. 20,000 barrels worth brewing at any one time. Sir Richard Muir, his son, Sir Henry, had followed in the family tradition, and the Horseshoe Brewery contained a 22-foot-tall vat that was capable of holding 18,000 imperial barrels of porter.
That's a lot of booze.
It's a lot of booze. These vats were fortified by 81 metric tons of iron hoops.
So you can imagine the Hooper had a hell of a day when that order came in.
Mm.
Mm. So they have these giant vats. They have many vats of similar sizes, all containing the porter that has been brewing for several months as it matures. But around 4:30 in the afternoon on the 17th of October, 1814, one of the storehouse clerks notices that one of the 700-pound iron bands around the 22-foot vat had slipped, which is not a good sign, but these things do happen. No. They happen. The vat that contains 3,500 imperial barrels of porter, 33 tons worth of it, it seems okay. It's not uncommon hoop slippage, so he makes a note to fix it. And just as the foreman was writing a letter to one of the owners going, you really must look at your barrels and get them fixed, the hoop fell off completely and the vessel burst.
Mm.
Yes, 33 tons of liquid. The pressure of the burst caused a stopcock of a neighbouring vat to fly off. All the other barrels were shattered by the force and around 320,000 gallons of porter was released. You've got to wonder what will happen when that happens.
Some sort of tidal wave through the streets of London.
Well, the rear wall of the brewery is completely destroyed.
Yeah.
That's how much booze there was. And a 15-foot tidal wave of porter swept into New Street, into the slum. This is probably both a welcoming and terrifying sight to people. Free beer! Free killer beer! The blob. Oh, it's got to be in his clutches. So two houses are destroyed immediately. Two more were very badly damaged. But the problem is that the beer is literally tsunamiing through the slums, sweeping everything away in its path, and it has fatal consequences. Very sadly, a four-year-old girl was having a tea party with her friend and her mother. And I know this is really sad, but also picture the genteel scene of china cups and finger sandwiches of my tea, Vicar, and then a tidal wave of beer sweeps through the house and knocks them all out the door. And the four-year-old girl was one of the fatalities involved. Yeah. The second, it's sad but also funny, the second house that was hit, there was an Irish wake going on.
Seems appropriate, surely.
Yes, for a young boy who had died in a non-beer related accident. But there is a wake going on, the family and the mourners, they're all probably drinking and singing, and then they're hit by a beer tsunami. Everyone in the house died from that.
That's dramatic. But if you're gonna go, I mean,
that's
a way to go, though, isn't it?
This is it. It's very sad people lost their lives, but there's still a little bit of you going, well, if you're gonna go, what happened? They all drowned in some beer at a wake. There was a teenager who was crushed by the falling wall. She worked in the local pub. The trouble with the flood of beer, you would think in this day and age as well, that it was like, okay, we'll just, it might knock some things over, but it'd be swept away. But these are the slums. There's no drainage. So everything is flooded. Everything is pretty gross. Actually, no one died in the warehouse. Whoever's standing, the foreman is standing there drenched in beer, holding the note he was going to send off, looking at the chaos in front of him, going, well, I'm fired. Now, of course, when the news of this accident spreads, people leap into action.
And they run to get some free beer.
Collecting as much beer as humanly possible. Vats, wash buckets, anything. Dancing and drinking in the streets, swimming, doing the backstroke. There would be reports of mass drunkenness and alcohol poisoning because the beer isn't suitable to drink. It's not ready. People may be embellishing the story over time. Some say there were no reports of such behaviour in the press, but others saying it was a positively carnival atmosphere while dead bodies are floating past. But the area was completely devastated and people came from all around to see the mess and the broken vats at the warehouse. There's not much else to do those days. So it was like, yeah, let's come and see this site of devastation. The staff charged admission for people coming around and seeing the site. A lot of people, though, who came to the area did donate to the families of the victims or the people who were killed in the accident. Not really a victim of the beer.
A victim beer, yeah.
Another wake for the mourners from the first wake was held at a nearby pub, which was probably a very, very tense occasion because you've got to think, if a wave of beer has hit you, what is coming next? Just loads of pizza! There. So all in all, 8 people died in what was known as the London Beer Flood, including 3 children. An inquest that was held on the 19th of October returned a verdict that these people had lost their lives casually, accidentally, or by misfortune. Casually losing your life?
Casually using your life. Okay.
Yeah, it's a bit mean.
Yeah.
The incident was deemed an act of God by the insurers.
Okay. What way can we possibly not pay out of this?
Well, it meant that the brewery did not have to pay compensation to the families. Yeah. As I said, a lot of people raise money for them, but they didn't have to pay compensation. And an act of God, if he is going to send a tidal wave of beer. But the disaster cost the company £23,000 in that day and age. They petitioned Parliament to help them out, and they recovered about £7,000 worth, saving them from bankruptcy. But the brewery was ultimately demolished in the 1920s, and the Dominion Theatre is built on the site today. The Mew and Co. brewery went into liquidation in 1961, and as a result of the accident, large wooden tanks were phased out across the brewing industry and replaced with lined concrete vessels. They'd learnt their lesson. So yes, that was the London beer flood. There were two similar sort of incidents. You also have the Dublin whiskey fire of 1875. This is where about £54,000 worth of whiskey in a storehouse somehow caught fire.
Okay.
And a stream of fiery whiskey started pouring out of the doors and windows straight down the street. This is Dublin. Fire's not going to stop anyone from getting a drink.
No, absolutely.
No, everyone Bring was in the on. Street gathering up the burning liquid. 13 people died as a result and 24 people in hospital, all due to alcohol poisoning.
All due to internal flames.
Flaming shots. Yeah, because again, the whiskey's not ready to drink. And they're just like, yeah, just fine, just get
and
the
it's
drink.
On fire.
It's on fire.
Which doesn't help.
That's just dressing. It's fine. It's still good drink. There was also the Great Molasses Flood in Boston. Do you know that story?
I know of that story, yes.
Yeah, it's only small details I have. But in 1919, it's a 12,000 ton tank of molasses burst and flooded the streets at 35 miles an hour. And that had the biggest death toll, 21 dead and 150 injured.
See that, because that's going to, because molasses, it's thick and heavy. Oof. And if it hits you, it's going to knock you. If
well,
that,
it's like
that weight of it.
Yeah,
it's going to be like having to get a bloody sandbag in the face.
Oh, and also like tar as well.
Yeah.
It's going to stick to you. It's going to burn your skin off and be. Bleh. They say that the area around there for years and still does today smells of sweet molasses. It doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
It does, but they did say for ages, like, oh, it smells very nice here. It's because everyone died.
Because everyone's dead. It's the sweet dead. Stench of death.
That's the slogan for people
yeah,
visiting.
Absolutely. Molasses, the sweet smell of death.
Little tip for you, molasses. I wonder if I've said this on the show before, but I'm going to say it again. Apparently, molasses in milk, brilliant hangover cure. Or something you should have after, if you've been out for a whole night drinking and dancing. I learnt this from a guy who worked at the Appleton Rum Factory in Jamaica. And he swore by it. And he's like, we'd be out dancing in Montego Bay at 4 a.m. You take a big spoonful of molasses in milk, set about 3 alarm clocks because you will be out cold, but it replaces all of the natural vitamins and everything, gives you the best sleep ever, but you need to set loads of alarm clocks to wake yourself up, and then yeah, and then you're rocking the next day. And he was like, yeah, that's what I was doing last night, and now I'm here for my job. Like, hey, so you work at a rum factory, you're still drunk, mate.
Well, perhaps we should try that. But one day we need to do a test of hangover cures.
Oh yeah. Oh, maybe
so
that will
really drunk, and we'll do a variety of hangover cures.
Yeah, I'm tasting non-alcoholic stuff this month and doing videos. Next month it'll all be about how to cure my hangover.
Right, okay, sounds like a plan. So hey. You can have so molasses and milk is one of them. So
indeed. Would you like another story?
No.
No, that's it. You're done?
Oh, go on then.
Oh, okay. Now, story number
Only
two.
Only if it's about turnips.
It's not about turnips. No, I could work a turnip in there.
Please do. Please
okay.
do.
Okay. It involves a murder of a turnip at a trial by spirits. See what I did there? See what I did there? Oh, God. The look on your face, like, shut up, woman. Insurance broker Stephen Young was standing trial for murder in 1994. In England.
Ooh, quite recent.
And the case seemed pretty cut and dried.
Yeah.
The 35-year-old from Kent, Pembrey, had allegedly gunned down two acquaintances in their home in Brighton in a cold-blooded attempt to snatch their money.
And their turnips.
He knew that they had the good turnips. They had the dream turnip
they had the
in
good
there.
Turnips.
The good turnips. No, just money. But he was going to get the money to buy more turnips.
Okay.
Stephen was facing bankruptcy.
He's been buying too many turnips.
That's it. I accidentally wrote bankruptcy in capital letters, and I didn't change it. Yes, and I didn't change it. And I went, oh, I must remember not to shout that. I just can't be bothered. And I got drunk. He was facing bankruptcy. So I didn't listen to my own advice. But there we go. This was fun.
They're jolly, very jolly chap.
It is. So he's facing bankruptcy, having apparently frittered away his cash on gambling and good times. Now he's amassed mountains of debt in his business and personal life. So now he needs money badly. And it just so happened that he knew that car dealer Harry Fuller kept flipping great wads of cash in his house.
Flipping great wads of cash.
Flipping great wads of cash. I'm doing all the Blackadder references in this episode. Okay, I'm just sneaking them in there. So he thought, why not make an appointment to see him at home about a car? Because that's where all good car deals are made, in your house. Maybe it was about insurance claims. Maybe he had set up on some sort of false premise. Who knows? But either way, in February in 1993, Stephen came to Harry's home armed with a pistol. Stephen had been the treasurer of a local rifle club, but he'd also had access to plenty of unregistered weapons. So finding a gun wasn't an issue for him. So we've got to think he doesn't have the best intentions when turning up for his meeting with Harry.
If you arrive at a business meeting with a gun, I think generally there's some bad feeling going on there.
Or that you just know how to negotiate.
That is that, yes. Fair
a
point.
Gun helps.
A gun, yes.
With all negotiations.
Can't deny that, actually. Yes, no, fair point. I must remember that. Yeah.
When he entered Harry's home, it doesn't take long before he draws the gun and he shoots Harry dead. Shoots him in the head.
See, this is not a good negotiation.
No, he didn't even try.
No.
Harry wasn't alone. Stephen also discovered that Harry's wife, Nicole, was in the house and he shot her 4 times. Apparently, during this attack, she had crawled to the bedroom, I think it was, and she had managed to dial 999 during the attack and her screams could be heard in the recording. It would be
this
later played in court.
It's not a jolly story.
It's not a jolly story, but stay with me. With the couple dead, Stephen thought it best to try and cover his crime, maybe make it look like a drug deal had gone wrong. Now, whether Harry and Nicole or Stephen were involved in drugs, I have no idea. I'm going to venture that they weren't, because Stephen decided the best way to make it look like a drug bust gone wrong was to scatter powdered sugar all over Harry's body and the flat.
Okay, now that's quite jolly.
Bags of sugar just flung about the place. Drug bust
doing
of the
like
century.
A Christmas scene. It's like, oh, it's snowing! As you do with the sieve and the icing sugar.
Maybe he got carried away and started just dusting all of the thing.
Make it look lovely in here.
He was doing snow angels. Like, oh shit, I gotta go. No one would ever know. Yeah, because there's no way that if you see a dusting of you know, drugs, you don't test for them. You just assume that it's all drugs. Everything powdery is drugs. Bear that in mind. The next day, as the pair lay dead in their home, Stephen was off depositing £6,000 that he had stolen from their home in his bank account. But it didn't take the authorities long to track Stephen down. Apparently, a recording of his voice during another meeting with Harry was played on Crime Watch, and an anonymous tip-off led the police straight to him. Now, at first, he denied it all. He claimed that he had arrived at their house, yes, and merely found the poor victim's bodies, but he did see a mysterious face in the upstairs window who vanished. I think they lived in a flat. He also claimed later that, well, he had to stay quiet because the real murderer had threatened him or he couldn't say anything. But it definitely wasn't him, so they should definitely let him go based on that evidence.
Definitely, definitely.
Well, he'd also been caught on CCTV, leaving the crime scene, so he's kind of screwed. And it was a horrible murder, a terrible, terrible tragedy, and he was found guilty at trial. And cheers erupted in the courtroom as justice was handed out. Sussex Police Detective Graham Hill said there was relief when the case was finished. Obviously, all people that were involved in the prosecution were pleased that the verdict was one of guilty because, as you can imagine, a huge amount of work goes into a case like this. So, case closed. No, it isn't.
I was going to say, if it was,
that's a terrible story.
That was a terrible story.
1 month after the trial ended and Stephen was already serving his sentence, the presiding judge ordered that a mistrial had to be recorded and that the whole process would have to be done again. This is thanks to some information that had arisen and had ended up on the front page of the News of the World. The headline read, "Murder Jury's Ouija Board Verdict."
Okay.
Subheading, booze, dirty jokes, and then the Ouija board.
Sounds like a great evening.
The youngest member of the jury, a 24-year-old man, had come forward to the authorities. Whether he had come forward or whether the information had slipped out, maybe to a member of the press, we don't know. What had emerged is that he revealed that the jury, when they had been sequestered in the Old Ship Hotel during the trial, the jury obviously have to stay in a hotel, don't talk to anyone, can only hang out with each other. Four of them had gotten a bit merry one night. A few drinks were had and some conversation was exchanged. And then they decided, as they knocked back the spirits, why not ask the spirits about the case itself?
Brilliant. I think I actually remember this.
As the other jurors slept, the quartet made a Ouija board out of a piece of paper and they got a hotel room wine glass while they were full. And they put a finger on top of the glass and the juror described what happened. They asked the spirit to guide the glass over the letters of the alphabet or the words yes and no. One juror, a man named Ray, took charge, addressed the spirit. And within a matter of moments, the glass was moving and the spirit revealed itself to be Harry Fuller.
Oh, God.
Ray really? Asked, who killed you? The glass spelt out, Stephen Young done it. He said, how? The glass spelled, shot. I don't know whether they're thinking shots then or kind of gunshot.
Indeed, yeah.
They asked what they should do. The glass spelled out, vote guilty tomorrow. You can probably sense that the spirit is getting annoyed at this point.
Yeah.
Vote guilty, for God's sake. Why are you asking?
And also, I mean, I think traditionally, these sorts of things are quite vague and you have to sort of interpret the instructions given by the spirits and things. This is quite direct, quite to the point.
Yeah, it's so, you would think it might spell out guilty.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Not
vote guilty tomorrow.
Specifically tomorrow. I know what date is happening. Vote guilty tomorrow. Don't waste my time. So yes, the group retired to their rooms and they had agreed not to tell the others what they had done. But when news of their actions got out, it did throw the trial up in the air. Because following the newspaper revelations, the Court of Appeal quashed the double murder conviction of Stephen Young and they ordered a retrial. The Lord Chief Justice, Lord Taylor, said he had heard arguments from both sides in the Court of Appeal and the prosecution tried to argue that the court shouldn't elevate a drunken experiment to say that it had influenced proceedings. You can't just say that because they got drunk and did a Ouija board that this made their decision. Of course they based it on everything that was in court, but ultimately they didn't convince the judge and a second trial was ordered. So Stephen Young was found guilty once again.
Yeah, surprise.
Yeah, 5-week hearing. It still took another 5 weeks, another load of public money that was spent in December 1994, and he was sentenced, he was convicted. The drunken actions of the jury, either bored or shaken up by the violence of the crime or just fuddled with drink, nearly cost Harry and Nicole's family their right to justice. So that's another reason why you should never mess with Ouija boards.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the reason why.
Well, that is the story of the Ouija board jury and the London beer flood and the turnip man.
And the turnip man. The turnip man. I want to hear more about the turnip man, to be honest.
I'll see if I can find some while we're talking.
I mean, why would you do a Ouija boardy thing? That's just entirely stupid. And there's obviously one of the juror people there entirely convinced that they know what's going on. Of the guilt and persuading the others to do it.
Well, it just seems like they're bored and they're just in the hotel trying to pass the time and kind of go, oh, someone thinks they have the sight. Or someone thinks, oh my goodness, we'll ask the spirits about what happened.
Mm.
And it leads to the trial nearly being thrown out.
Stupid thing to be doing. That's very silly. I remember that one. Yeah, from the 90s. Because it was just so ludicrous. I think I remember it in the news and things.
It's the sort of thing we would have read if we'd seen it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, for people to do that is just entirely, entirely mad.
I have found some information about Sir William Payne Gullway.
Okay.
Let me see.
I'm intrigued.
I found this on the Victorian Commons website. This is live, people. He was out shooting in the parish of Bagby. And in crossing a turnip field, fell with his body onto a turnip, sustaining severe internal injuries. Although all that medical aid could do was done, he was 73 at the time, already in failing health, he did not recover from his encounter with the turnip. buried at his local parish church 3 days later.
Right.
No one has made more mention of this turnip. No one avenged his death.
I mean, he was out with his hunting buddies in a... Yeah, whatever.
In a field, and he fell down, and he accidentally fell on a turnip.
This is some sort of weird sort of Victorian cruising thing going on there. Obviously, the Turnip Field was the place where everyone hung out. It was the place to be.
Bagby. We should find out if that was a cruising spot.
Yeah. So let's look at the Turnip Fields of Bagby for cruising in the Victorian era.
There is a picture of him. I think I might use it. He does look rather dashing in his hunting outfit with his hat and his pipe and his massive moustache. So there we go. Yes. The most intriguing story is the man who was killed, murdered by a turnip. I wonder if his family made a soup.
What, out of him?
Well, no, out of the turnip, but now actually after what we've said, I don't think they'd want to use that turnip. No.
No, not really, no.
No,
I
think no.
No. I don't want that one. Not once it's been inserted about someone.
Oh, God. Yeah. Just determined.
Well, no, I mean, if he's fallen, and I'm assuming, I don't know, has it gone through his chest?
Or maybe it just like...
his heart as he fell. Or he fell and it went through his eye into his brain.
Or maybe it landed on a kidney or like the, you know, the kidneys of the liver. He landed really badly.
You went rude with that one.
I did not go rude with that one.
Entirely legitimate sort of turn it through the head.
How quickly you change your mind. Don't you try and crawl out of the gutter now, Nick Gordon. Well, what do you think, people? What do you think of our compendium of crazy deaths and weird circumstances? Do you know any more crazy murder stories or weird methods of murder that are out there, or any stories out there that are just quite bizarre rather than dark and depressing?
Do you enjoy a turnip?
Indeed, do you enjoy a turnip? What other vegetables are responsible for people's deaths? They must be stopped, people. They are the greatest poison of them all.
Oh, imagine falling on a carrot.
Ooh,
that's going to go right through you.
Oh, that is better.
That's going to come out the other side.
And then being swept away in a tidal wave of beer.
Yeah.
Covered in vegetables. Jesus Christ. Our food and drink is after us. Tell us what you think. Share more ideas of stories or recommendations for us. Tell all your friends about the poisoner's cabinet. And generally, just be careful out there when you're wandering through a turnip field.
It's a dangerous place.
And anywhere near a brewery, stay away from that until February. Thanks for listening, guys. We will see you on Friday for the main episode. We will see you next week for more deadly nightcaps. But in the meantime, keep drinking, keep talking about poison, and remember, your loved ones and vegetables are trying to kill you.
Bye.